Welcome back to AEIOU, the podcast about Austria. This is Andrew, your host. Our last episode ended with the rise of nationalism in the Habsburg Empire and the Carlsbad Decrees, which were issued in 1819 to curtail freedom of the press and assembly in attempts to nip liberal and nationalist political activities in the bud. In this episode, we'll pick up in the 1820s and look at the last 15 years of the reign of Emperor Francis II and the reign of his son, Emperor Ferdinand. As we noted in the previous episode, the university-based Burschenschaften movement, which you will recall was a fraternal movement of young men committed to athletics and political discussion, had left the ruling elites of Austria deeply suspicious of the younger generations. The elites were distrustful of the Burschenschaften because of these young men's embrace of liberalism and nationalism, which were regarded as the twin demons of radical politics during this period. This suspicion gave rise not only to the aforementioned Carlsbad decrees, but also to the introduction of secret police, who were charged with monitoring political discourse for potential dissident activity. In short, what appears in Austria after 1815 is what the scholar Mark Reiff called a well-ordered police state. In fact, Reiff had traced the development of the police state from as far back as the Reformation, seeing its emergence as a key part of the enlightened absolutism common to Central and Eastern Europe in the 7th and 18th centuries. For Austria, this process began under Joseph II, but it truly came into full bloom under Francis II, who employed spies along with political peace to ensure domestic stability under his reign. We should be clear that the police state, as used here, is different from the 20th century connotation of the term as exemplified in Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union, in which secret police pervaded daily existence, exercised disproportionate power, and held decision-making authority over life and death. Rather, this police state was one in which police became a commonplace presence for the preservation of public order, both in controlling and fighting crime and in monitoring political activity. As liberalism gained ground across Europe, the latter charge of police would recede and the former responsibility for crime fighting would come to the fore. As liberalism gave way to reactionary politics after World War I, the latter role would return. Another major change undertaken in the last 15 years of Francis's reign was the cutting of the imperial military budget. With the wars with France finally over and a German confederation established to maintain peaceful relations in Austria's part of Europe, more money could now remain in the government coffers and the size of Austria's military scaled down. When Francis died in 1835, he had spent 43 years ruling Austria, surpassing the 40-year reigns of Leopold VI and Maria Theresa. Only his grandson, Franz Joseph, would rule Austria for longer. Francis had been married 4 times and sired 7 children who lived to adulthood. The eldest, Maria Louise, as we discussed in an earlier episode, was married off to Napoleon and had given birth to the ill-fated Napoleon II. Upon the defeat of Napoleon, the Congress of Vienna determined that Maria Louise would be the Duchess of Parma, and she held that title until her death in 1847. Once Napoleon died in 1821, Maria Louise could marry again. But in marrying a noble below her rank, namely the one-eyed Count Adam Albert von Neipperg, her children were disqualified from following her on the throne of Parma. The throne subsequently passed to the Bourbon dynasty. After Maria Louise, among Emperor Francis's children, the second child was the eldest son, Ferdinand. According to the rules of succession, Ferdinand was the heir to the Austrian throne. There was a problem, however. Ferdinand was substantially developmentally disabled. Among his problems was hydrocephalus, or water on the brain, giving the crown prince an unusually large head. In addition, he suffered from epileptic seizures, seizures that apparently prevented him from being able to consummate his marriage in 1831 to Maria Anna of Savoy. Needless to say, the couple had no children. You might recall that this was not the first time that something like this had happened in the Habsburg family. Back in the 18th century, King Charles II of Spain had died childless after 35 years on the throne. Charles had been born with a rather severe set of birth defects. It is suspected today that Charles's condition was the result of inbreeding. His parents were an uncle and niece. The same conjectures have been made about Emperor Ferdinand, whose parents were also an uncle and niece. The good news in the case of Ferdinand was that there was no longer any shortage of Habsburgs to pick up the slack if and when Ferdinand died childless. The option existed for Ferdinand to be declared incapacitated and to give the throne of Austria to Ferdinand's younger brother, Franz Karl, who was next in line. However, the decision was made instead to put Ferdinand on the throne and have a regency council do the actual business of governing. This type of solution was one that normally would be reserved for cases in which the heir to the throne was a minor when the monarch died. such regency councils had ruled for Louis XIV in France and Henry VI in England, both of whom were infants when they became kings. A regency council was also used in Britain when it became clear, not long before the case of Ferdinand becoming emperor, that King George III was unfit to rule because of his insanity. The regency council consisted of three men. The first was Archduke Ludwig, a younger brother of Francis II, who had been a trusted advisor and confidante to his brother. The second was Count Franz Anton von Kahl of Rotliegsteinsky, who had served in Francis's government as Minister of the Interior and Minister of Finance. The third and final member of the council was a man we have already heard quite a bit about, Clemens von Metternich, the foreign minister whom Francis had named as Chancellor in 1821. Metternich, we should recall, was largely responsible for presiding over the Congress of Vienna and for promulgating the Carlsbad decrees in response to the rise of liberalism and nationalism. In the latter matter in particular, Metternich frequently clashed with Kahl of Rot, who was sympathetic to nationalist movements, including the movement of the Czech people in Habsburg Bohemia. Together, these three men formed what was called the Secret State Conference or
Geheime Staatskonferenz.
It was this body that actually ruled Austria from the accession of Ferdinand as emperor until 1848. Each man would continue to serve in their previous roles. Archduke Ludwig acted as head of state, Kahl of Rot ran internal affairs, and Metternich ran external or foreign affairs. The dozen years during which the Secret State Conference governed Austria has been characterized as stagnant but stable. On the one hand, the status quo of absolutism under Francis continued under the Secret State Conference because of the inherently adversarial nature of its members. On the other hand, since the period was one of limited military concerns with the end of the wars with France and emergence of the German Confederation, there was domestic stability and a benign diplomatic climate. Kahl of Rot nearly managed to balance the government's budget despite the massive debt incurred by Austria during the wars with Napoleon. The burgeoning textile industry emerged along the Danube with strongholds in Lower Austria and Bohemia. Finally, the capital continued to grow as an important center of commerce and culture, with a population of nearly 500,000 people by mid-century. With these factors all in its favor, the Austrian Empire appeared well positioned to enter the second half of the 19th century, continuing to hold great power status and entering the industrial age with good financial health. This vision for the future would not last long, however. 1848 was arguably the most revolutionary year in the history of Europe. It would be difficult to overestimate the extent to which upheaval overtook the continent, from France in the west to the Russian Empire in the east. Difficult material conditions for working people, including widespread hunger, was a key reason for the revolution in France, but the spread of the revolution east from there seemed to be more a result of a sort of contagion. Once it became clear that dissatisfied people in one country could make demands and have them granted, populations in other countries followed suit. Generally speaking, these demands took the form of constitutional reform. Where absolute rule still existed in Europe, it was challenged by workers, the urban bourgeoisie, and reformers within government. In many cases, including in Austria, constitutional reform was granted. However, in most of these cases, reform was eventually overturned. By the middle of 1849, much of Europe was back under absolute rule. The other major force at work in the revolutions of 1848 was nationalism. In several of the places where the revolution took hold, including Italy, Hungary, and parts of the German Confederation, the goal was greater national self-determination or freedom from what was considered to be foreign rule. As in the cases of constitutional reform, these attempts at nationalist change were largely unsuccessful, although they set a precedent for later, more successful attempts a couple of decades down the road. The trouble began in Italy, specifically in Palermo, the capital of Sicily. Sicily was then part of the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, which had its capital at Naples on the Italian peninsula. A creation of the Congress of Vienna, the kingdom was controlled by the Bourbon dynasty, which also ruled Spain. The Bourbon dynasty was deeply unpopular, particularly in Sicily, where it had curtailed some of the autonomy that Sicily had previously enjoyed. Revolution broke out in January 1848 and was temporarily successful, although ultimately the Bourbons were returned to power by the middle of the following year. However, the initial revolution in Sicily had important repercussions for Europe as a whole, as well as specifically for Austria. On the one hand, news of revolution in Sicily spread and inspired similar revolutionary outbreaks, first in France but subsequently across nearly the entire continent. Major focuses of revolutionary activity over the subsequent year and a half included several of the members of the German Confederation, including Baden, Bavaria, Prussia, and of course Austria itself. Perhaps more importantly than the revolutionary activity that consumed the Austrian capital of Vienna was that which seized Hungary and resulted in the most protracted and consequential struggle of the entire revolutionary period, which was the Hungarian Revolution. That's how the revolution in Sicily impacted the continent. On the other hand, the more local spread of revolutionary fervor from Sicily within Italy ultimately culminated in the First Italian War of Independence. Now, let's bear something in mind. This is a podcast about Austria, not one about Italy. That said, the First Italian War of Independence is an important thing for a podcast about Austria to consider because the primary opponent of the side fighting for independence will be Austria, in alliance with the Pope. How Italian nationalism proceeded up the Italian peninsula from Sicily and culminated in this war is what we'll discuss in the next episode. Thanks for listening.